Ladies and gentlemen, and fellow golfers, for your entertainment.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa, brought to you by Hagen Oaks, America's most awarded golf facility, and Naturewood Home Furnishings, where it's all about choices and always about quality.
Hello and welcome to another hour of the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on... Scott, this is the first time I've said Sacktown Sports 1140. How about that?
You got it right, Frank. Yeah, it sounds good. We're real excited about our rebrand and just all the new things that we're offering to people. It's all about bringing more and covering the local sports as much as we can. And Frank, of course, this show's a big part of it in terms of covering the local golf scene and all we're doing to get the word out about the great game of golf.
And, you know, the brand may change, but the Golf to Go Radio Hour will continue to be right down the middle of the fairway, fairways and greens. That's what we're looking for, right?
We're always looking for them. I have a hard time finding them, Frank, but definitely true.
Exciting night with the draft underway. And obviously there's more to talk about that. But right now we've got golf in front of us and another exciting show. Len Dumas, the executive director of the Northern California PGA, is going to be here to talk about their Hall of Fame event coming up this weekend in Reno, which I have a little part in, and Len's always exciting.
Len's great. And, you know, obviously this is a big event over the weekend that's going to be held up in Reno. And I know you have a big part of what's going on with that and some new members going into the Hall of Fame. Look forward to hearing all about that.
You know, I talked to Tom Martin, PGA Director of Coaching and Development at Hagen Oaks, because we tend to think that if we're going to go get fitted, we're going to get fitted for drivers and irons, and then we're pretty much set to go out and play golf. But there's another bag in the, or another club in the bag that, you know, makes up for an awful lot of strokes during your round, and that's the putter. And we talked a little bit about, you know, whether looking at a putter and deciding whether it fits is really the right way to go. There is a system called putter fitting, and Tom is going to talk about that and the benefits of it, and maybe even talk a little bit about how to practice your putting.
Yeah, no, I look forward to your interview with him. I recently got fitted for a putter, got my Ping putter. I've been working with that and trying to work through some of the wrinkles. It was really interesting because I don't know if most people think about it, but the loft on your putter is really important. You think about that with your clubs and certainly your driver. You think so much about how it's set. Well, it's just as critical with your putter. The one thing I realized when I went through the fitting process is that I tend to lift my putter, which can take it offline. And so the angle and the degrees that it's set at is specifically for my swing. Now, I'm hoping it saves me a few strokes. We're going to find out, Frank, but it was definitely a great process to go through.
You know, I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time with Dave Stockton, who is the short game guru. And I've heard Dave say so many times, he won't even look at a putter unless it has 4 degrees of loft. So you're absolutely right. The loft has so much to do with getting that good roll. And Tom and I talk a bit about that. You're going to have a great interview with Chris Biederman from the Sacramento Bee. And a while back, Chris did a really cool story in the paper about, you know, his frustration of being a golfer, his frustration and his love, which is something we all go through. It's universal. And I'm looking forward to hearing that one as well.
Yeah, there's no question. It was a great column back a couple of weeks ago. It was about the love-hate relationship with golf, golf being the best/worst thing to ever happen during the pandemic. And so, you know, any golfer, especially duffers like myself, can relate to the article he wrote about. And we're looking forward to talking to Chris. Obviously, he's the beat writer for the 49ers, and he does a lot of stuff as it pertains to the NBA draft and all of that as well. So we're looking forward to having a great conversation with him.
And talks to the universality. There we go.
Yeah.
I knew there was a word in there somewhere of the game. And I, you know, I'm imagining that that's what our audience is, that universally, you know, kind of have it either just an interest in the game or a pure love. It's, you know, it's a long road, you know, from one end to the other. But there are many of us that like to travel that road every day.
Well, as I've found out from playing golf and really having the bug myself, hate is a form of love because I absolutely hate the game sometimes, but it's because I care about it so much. Hate is an emotion that tells you how you feel about something.
Strong emotions, one way or the other.
Yeah.
This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour on Sacktown Sports 1140. We will be back with Mr. Len Dumas, PGA, right after these messages.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa.
Golf to Go Radio Hour is always excited to have our friend Len Dumas back. Len is the executive director of the Northern California PGA, and he always fills us in on what's going on in golf in Northern California because he's the executive director of that organization. And that organization is representing 1,100 golf professionals in Northern California. So we want to talk to the man that has his finger on what's going on in golf. Len's the guy. Len, welcome to Golf to Go.
Frank, thank you. Scott, thank you so much. Again, great to be with you. And as I mentioned before we came on, I just enjoyed your piece at Hagen Oaks last week. I was driving home from one of our junior events, and it was just great to hear you and Mike Woods on the air at Hagen Oaks, and just fantastic for what you do for the game as well. So thank you for allowing us to be part of the family.
Absolutely. Thank you. Appreciate that. We were just happy we didn't get blown from our tent position where we were at last week. It was windy last week.
Yeah, it's coming right off the range, right in our face. We might have to think about doing that on the other side of the range next time. In any event, you know, Len, you've got an incredible event coming up this weekend, one in which I will have, a piece. I will be there to MC part of the semi-annual meeting for the Northern California PGA, because it's time for this new class, the 2022 class of the Northern California PGA Hall of Fame. And that's always an exciting night. And I'm always very excited to be a part of it. I appreciate the opportunity and love to kind of talk to you a little bit about the four people that are going into the Hall of Fame, and maybe start with why there is a Hall of Fame for the Northern California PGA. And then let's talk about this year's class.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. You know, this is our fifth year, but officially our 122nd year as organization. And so as we looked at what we were doing in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and 2000, you know, finally the bell rang. Hey, we need to start honoring those that have brought us through these decades of various parts of the game, but also the business of golf as well. We tend to think of the players, but there are business people here. There are educators here that have been all part of our timeline. And so 2018 was our first year. We put our qualifications together, if you will, our applications, our entries. And we had a lot of catching up to do 2018, 2019. We were back, honoring our Northern California influencers, let's use a modern word, and our members from the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and now we're up to current day. So we have 25 in our first 4 years. We brought in 25 to our Hall of Fame, and we have four more, as you mentioned, right here in 2022. And we will celebrate this weekend as our semi-annual meeting has really become more, let's celebrate more than business. We'll do the business we need to do. So it's become noted for our Hall of Fame induction and our semi-annual.
You know, Sactown Sports 1140 has a huge footprint in Northern California. So I'm not surprised to, as you talk about these folks going in, that many of our listeners will have had some sort of contact with these people, because, they're all sort of within listening distance.
Yeah, Frank, they've influenced all of us, whatever our role is in the Northern California PGA, certainly, but even in the PGA, or even as players, as golfers, they've influenced us over the years. And I'll talk about two, John Fry, the Fry family has the Fry family's fabric of golf. They started in 1910 in Washington as caddies, and we've honored the John's uncle. John's father, rather, Dick Fry, and his brothers, they're all part of the fabric, all coming through Lake Sherbeau. Mike Rauwitzer, Mike became a member, in 1966, and John is coming up on his 60th year of membership in October of this year. And as I said, they played at a very high level, but they had that moment, right? Mike said when he played in the State Open, of all places, at El Macero in 1960, that lit him up. And then he took a little bit of a different tack in that he was very interested in club fitting and retail. And at the time, was working with Don Sherwood in Washington. And we all remembered the Sherwood golf stores. And then as things happened, he applied for head golf professional position, San Jose Municipal, back in 1968, and is still running and managing San Jose Muni took over Santa Teresa in 1981. And this is part of the story I love. It was time to retire. So Mike wanted to play more. He moved down to Paso Robles area in San Luis Obispo. He wanted to play more, so he regained his amateur status, so it was easier to play. But then, and his passion, cutting horses, raising and training cutting horses. Then his friends told him about the Paso Robles Country Club that was for sale. So he wound up buying it, and now he owns Paso Robles. So again, here's a story of a gentleman that's been through it all. In the 90s, was president of the section and led the agreement with Saddle Creek out in Copperopolis, which is still a long way from everywhere, but a little bit closer now as the home of the Northern California PGA. Mike was part of that as well. So I bring that up as a player, as a business person, as a retailer, as an owner. And those are the hats we wear. And same thing with John Fry. After leaving Harding Park in about 1974, when he left Harding Park, he then opened up the sporting stores near SFO for many, many years and managed that until 2005, continuing the family tradition. And as I mentioned, John's coming up on his 60th year of PGA membership. And so we look and we go back through the books and say, okay, how have we been influenced not only as players? You know, we came through Nicklaus and Palmer in the 90s. We had Mickelson and Tiger, of course. And now we have Cantlay, Morikawa, Marsh, and La Rosa. You know, the modern players just keep getting better and better. And but it's the business people. It's the support base that has been put in there by all of them. So, you know, kudos to Mike and John. And we thank them for influencing all of us so many ways in our industry.
You know, the fact that you mentioned their stories, you know, we kind of understand and meet people in the moment, how we see them. They're a golf professional. The fact that Mike Krawitzer, you know, was into cutting horses, it's, you know, it's just, I can hardly wait to hear him talk after his award, because I'm sure that's going to be part of the story.
Yeah. Frank, it's an interesting point. We go to a facility or meet someone, and that's our starting point. Right, that's our historic starting point. But you're absolutely right. We get to know them for whatever reason, sit down with them, talk with them, whether it's planned, whether it's serendipitous. And all of a sudden, oh, there's a whole person behind that. You know, we didn't start at 40. We didn't start at 50. We didn't start at 20. We didn't start at 70. And so the histories are just great. And, you know, Shim LaGoy is coming into our Hall of Fame this year as well. And again, Shim, PGA membership in 1978, has been an award winner in two sections. In Ohio and here in Northern California, has served as section president, has won our Patriot Golf Award. He's very involved with our PGA Hope programming now and working with our veterans and bringing them along in the game that we all love. 23 years as head golf professional at Orinda Country Club, section president, ran for district director, has been through the chairs and still leads and guides us, and pretty much started 100 Holes of Golf. 100 Holes of Golf has been around as a fundraiser for our foundation for many, many years. And what we've done, you know, it used to be not easy, but we got through playing 100 holes in one day, just going, going, going. But as we got a little older, we said, well, maybe we'll play 50 holes, and maybe we'll play alternate shots. So we just kept changing the format to make sure we to make sure we could still get to 100. But the goal was done, you know, and again, there's a starting point. And so we're really grateful and proud of Shim for everything that he's done in Northern California PGA and in golf.
You know what? And another thing that's really exciting about his story is that apparently that first time, or one of the early times, he decided to play 210 holes. You know, because he was spurred on by donations and you know, folks watching him. But the remarkable thing, he played that in one over par.
that's incredible, Frank.
That is very incredible.
Incredible, 210 holes. I mean, just the ability to just keep going.
No question.
And have enough daylight to do that. So God bless. I think that's just another testimony to the dedication.
You know, Sue Fisco obviously is our fourth. There's a connection, I suppose, in an odd way with Mike Krawitzer, in that when Sue was young, she had an interest in horses, but I guess her father decided that was too dangerous. So he got her into golf, and look what happened there.
Yeah. Another things happen, right? Frank, things happen for a reason. And her dad was afraid that she might get hurt. And so golf, for the most part, is a non-contact sport. We're all kind of grateful for that. And Sue started, worked it for Brad Lazarus. And Brad is just incredibly known here in Northern California PGA when it was Palo Alto Municipal Golf Course. There was quite a team that worked there. Mark Heptig was there and Sue was there and such. And, still great friends to this day. But the key with Sue, Frank's gotten that she was historic in the sense of being the first female section president in the PGA of America. So that was a big deal. Sue is decorated in the Northern California PGA, decorated in the LPGA, the Ladies Professional Golf Association, and broke the ceiling. And Sue ran for national secretary. Unfortunately, that didn't play out. But when Susie Whaley became secretary a few years ago, she acknowledged Sue and thanked Sue for stepping up and taking those first few steps, which have now have opened many, many doors. So, our thanks to Sue and our kudos for Sue for hanging in there in the male organization, if you will, which is very different than it was even 5-10 years ago. But and congratulations to Sue for not only coming in the Hall of Fame, but of course, being the first woman to be a section president and run for secretary.
The organization is well represented by these four people, no doubt. Scott, I know you were interested in what's going on this summer.
Oh, yeah, definitely want to talk about the summer league programs. I think it's interesting the connection with golf and horse racing, watching the U.S. Open and seeing that, the country club was basically an equine center for its first 50, 75 years and seeing the horse track literally, the outline of holes 18 and number one. So I'd say there's a good relationship between golf and horse racing everywhere in this country, Lon.
Yeah, Scott, I'll bring it a lot closer. Diablo Country Club had the same situation. The current 14, 15, 16th holes were also a racetrack, and they have pictures in the clubhouse with the overlay. Wow. And if you can recall, as you pull in to Diablo, the name of the road, I think it's Diablo Road before you get in. If you look to your left, right before you make the turn into the club, you will see a white picket fence with a flagpole in it. Yeah. There's a racehorse buried there.
Oh, wow.
So, much closer to our, but just fantastic when you think about that. But yeah, a great tie, a great open, particularly at a venue that was part of the original organizations of the USGA and the PGA.
And just the great amateur story too, right? With Francis Ouimet and everything else and learning that was the birth of golf in the United States.
Right. With balls that the feathers were sticking out of, with clubs that I can promise you were not balanced, right? And still playing the same game with golf course conditions entirely different than what we know. And yet they were still shooting the numbers. Wow.
Yeah, well, I yearned for the days where I could have had a triple bogey and a trifecta all on one hole. Yeah. That would have been pretty cool.
That's right.
Tell us about the summer leagues, because obviously now's the time for all of that kicking off.
Very much so, Scott. Thank you for that. And I say that from June 1st to August 15th, pretty much the kids are out of school. And we have this 75-day window of cramming everything we own into that and making sure we're going. So the junior tours are up and running now, the Junior Tour of Northern California, the American Junior Golf Association, the U.S. Kids event, and a couple of that we're very proud of, which is PGA Junior League, of course, which is golf in a team competition, which is all over our section, all over the country. And one that really is fun, and a couple of our staff members are out there today at Laguna Seca for our drive, chip, and putt competition. The players hit three drives, three chips, three putts, and then move to two regional levels, which will be in August. The first one, the second one is the final. And I bring this up because that's going to be at Pebble Beach. And those that are successful there head to Augusta. Yeah. So that's a pretty nice trip, Pebble to Augusta. And they compete on the Sunday before the Masters. And as a matter of fact, at our semi-annual meeting, this weekend, we will be acknowledging Jaden Dumdemaya, who actually won the boys' division at Augusta this year. So that's a wow.
Yeah, no, it was great. We had him on the program a couple of months back. It's such a great story.
It is, Scott. And, you know, we've got beginners. It starts at 7 years old and goes up to 15. And it's hard to believe you can age out at something at 16, right? But, you know, they're beginners. They're seasoned players. And doing it over the years, we get to watch them grow. And all of these, you know, missing a year and a half pretty much with COVID, many of them came back. They started shorter than us, but many of them came back taller than us. So it's great to know the families over the years.
There's always something going on in golf in Northern California. It sometimes would be a nice talent to have, to be able to walk away and see what's going on right next to us. I think we sometimes enjoy what we've got, but we don't recognize how rich what we've got here in Northern California really is. And a trip around the country, you know, certainly gives us an opportunity to recognize how fortunate we are to live in this part of the world. The golf and the activities that are going on in the game are just remarkable right here in our little river city.
Yeah, very much so, Frank. And again, thank you both for the support and the opportunity to talk about it. It's such sunshine these days with all the craziness going on, and just bringing the families back together and ourselves playing together, and the fun we have and the stories we create. And I really am selfish about it, but truly believe that only in golf can we do this.
I appreciate that, Len. And I'd be remiss if I wrap this section up without saying that even closer to home, Hagen Oaks was originally land that was a horse farm. I think it was Ben Ali Hagen was a Kentucky Derby horse that was there. So you're right, Scott. You may be onto something.
Well, that's good to know. When we're at our media league, I'll maybe try and place a bet or two out there.
There you go. Yeah. Len Dumas.
Keep in mind, Scott, we are, for the most part, a pretty conservative organization. So keep the betting discreet, if you don't mind.
Well, you've seen my golf game, so I really shouldn't be betting at all, Len. Got to keep it interesting.
Awesome. Len Dumas is the executive director of the Northern California PGA. This is the Golf to Go Radio Hour on Sactown Sports 1140. We'll be right back after this.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa.
Golf to Go Radio Hour continues here on Sactown Sports 1140. I'm Frank LaRosa, and we are here to welcome Mr. Tom Morton, PGA Director of Coaching and Development at the Hagen Oaks Golf Complex. Tommy, thanks so much for being with us here today on the show.
You got it, Frank. Thanks for having me.
You know, over the years, the notion of getting fitted for your golf clubs has certainly become kind of the standard practice, and everybody recognizes how important it is to have irons and a driver fit to, you know, your stance and your swing and really kind of your whole athletic posture. But I think the one club that maybe kind of gets forgotten in all of this and accounts for maybe more strokes on the course than any of the others is the putter. And it's really important, I think, to talk about not only putting and putting techniques, but getting fitted for a putter. And I think for a lot of people, that may be a surprise to know that you actually can be fitted for your putter. So, you know, I know you are quite familiar with the process and really are an advocate of it. So let's kind of start with, your reasons for advising one of your students maybe to get fitted for a putter.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Frank, to your point, just off the top of my head, if I think about, you know, we probably do close to, 50 plus driver fits a week at the studio, and we might do 1 to 3 putter fittings a week in our in the shop. Doesn't mean people aren't buying putters, but I think people aren't necessarily getting fits. I think that's definitely an abnormal difference there for sure. And you know what people should know is that, of course, putting is such a huge part of the game, but also the type of stroke they have, where they aim the putter. That's a big one that people don't really know about, is that the style of putter, whether it's a blade, a mallet, there's kind of crossover between ones, what kind of hosel configuration is on it, whether offset, whether it's center shaft, whether it's heel shafted, and so on and so forth. How many lines are on the putter, whether there's lots, whether there's a little alignment aid. All those things force people to aim more left or more right. And if somebody is a right aimer, they need some variables to help them force them back to the left. And the story I tell people when I'm fitting them for putters is when Casey Martin, who's now the University of Oregon men's head coach, and he was on the tour and during the time period where he was, there was the whole thing about him suing the tour for use of the cart because he had a bad leg. Well, his buddy who was local to Sacramento was caddying for him, and he wasn't putting very well, and he was visiting Steve. So Casey came and saw me, and I was talking to Casey about it, and he talked about how much he did not like offset on a putter. Well, the amazing thing was that he aimed so far left. I mean, he literally was aiming probably 10 feet left of his target on a 20-30 footer. I mean, that's just hard to believe for a great player. Well, he needed offset because offset looks left. So people that aim left, if you put that in their hand, they move more right. So we got him the right putter that had a ton of offset on it, and he started aiming it perfectly straight. And 2 weeks later, it was actually, he was playing on what is now the Korn Ferry Tour, and he ended up winning a couple weeks later. And it sent me a nice note because it was like it changed his world because he aimed better. He no longer had to overcome that. So finding the right putter style is super important. There's the length of the putter, there's a lie angle, there's loft, there's all that stuff that matters.
Boy, when you go through all of those options and it's overwhelming to even think that those things come into play. I mean, I walk into the shop and I look around and boy, there's a pretty silver one. I kind of like that black one. And that's probably the way most of us kind of pick a putter. And when I bend over the putt, well, yeah, this looks like it's going to be right. But to know that, and I find that I apparently aim to the right as well. And I wasn't aware of the fact that the style of putter that I chose can help, compensate for that. what an exciting attraction that is.
Yeah, because everyone's eyes see things a little different. And so finding the right one that fits the eye that forces you to, aim more square than any other. I have yet to, have someone come in to get fit that we can't improve aim just by the style of putter we're using. So it's a real important one. I know for years, I always avoided center shafted putters because when I set it down, it didn't appear like I liked the look of it, my eye. However, I aim a center shafted putter better than any. So I just started using them. And, once you know you're aimed really well, kind of now you just worry about speed and it turns out to be pretty good.
The notion that our body kind of pushes us into an aim that might be left or right. If we say we go with a center shafted putter like you did, what's to prevent the body from now deciding that, well, I can aim now, and I'm aiming more left than I did before, or whatever. Does the body end up overcompensating for the new putter that helps us aim correctly?
No, because I think people have tendencies, and I think those tendencies hold pretty true. And so, if you can find something to sort of, move that tendency and it moves you back to the middle, it tends to hold there pretty well.
That's really pretty cool. So what does a putter fitting entail? Our eyes are going to tell us one thing. We're going to walk in and go, I love the color of the grip on that one. And boy, that shaft really is kind of cool. And, I suppose that's in many ways not a whole lot different than we react to golf clubs, irons and drivers as well. What do we go through? What is the process that we go through to help us find the right putter? Or can you find the putter that we think is really kind of nice looking and fit it to what we need?
A lot of times we can. I mean, there's so many choices, right? I mean, you come into our putter corral and there's 800 putters sitting around there. And so, most of the time we can find something that both fits you and that they like. There's been an occasion or two where that hasn't been the case, but when they see the data and see what's happening with the roll of the ball, they quickly start liking it. So, but most of the time we can find that. And, just like getting a driver fitting or an iron fitting, we use TrackMan a lot. For putter things, there's a device that we use that is great for that, called the SAM Putt Lab, which stands for Science and Motion. And we basically, we clip a little triplet on the putter and it reads back and forth with the device. And it really gives us the timing of one stroke, you know, the style of one stroke, whether they have more rotation or less rotation in their stroke, where they're aiming it to the target, and all these different factors. And that really helps us, as a good starting point, to know where to go. And then as we dial it down and find that putter that's working for them, you'll see the data points improve.
So we go through the process, we find a putter, and now all of a sudden we're great putters because you fitted the putter to us, and you know we're good from there. We're going to one and two putt every green. I guess that's not the case. What, you know, when, once we put, I didn't mean to interrupt, but the notion is that it doesn't mean that it takes the whole theory of practice out of the equation, and repetition and learning how to practice correctly, I guess, is what I was trying to get at.
What it will take out is, let's say again, someone's a right aimer, and they're aiming right at the target, their stroke most likely is going to be kind of either out to in pull across, or maybe in and over the top pull across. But either way, they're going to be pulling across it. It's going to have an imperfect roll on the golf ball. And it's really hard to be good at distance control when you're not hitting it solidly and putting a good roll on the ball. So, you know, that's why starting there, getting that putter that's working and our aim solid and getting you in a neutral place to be able to go from is really important, so that when we do dive into the kind of the discussion and science of how to practice and get better, you're in a place to be able to do it.
You know, when you talk about putting a good roll on the ball, I think all of us know what that means. We've all seen it. We've all maybe even experienced it ourselves. But to be able to do it consistently is not always that easy to do. I remember years ago you giving me a little bit of a putting lesson, and it certainly helped for a while. And I'm guessing that maybe some of the basics or the mechanics of that have kind of gone out of my pre-putter routine. But to be able to roll the ball well, everybody knows it. Everybody will say on the green, wow, that's a great roll. What's the difference between being able to put a good roll on the ball and not? And how do we, you know, get to that point?
It's not really different than a full swing, right? It's delivering the head and face of the putter squarely to the ball. I mean, that really is, I know it seems way oversimplified, but it's not, learning to do that. And there's different ways to do it. I mean, look this weekend, right? You would hear a lot about how Zalatoris' stroke, they would call it wobbly. And if you looked at it, it had kind of a little funky little takeaway, but let's be real. He can deliver that putter head back to the golf ball pretty darn squarely. You don't have a chance to tie for the US Open if you can't. So, there is a lot of ways to do it, but it's about getting, you know, the right tool in their hand to do it and, you know, practicing correctly to do it. And most people, you know, if we, you know, it's fun to hit balls, it's fun to hit the driver, it's fun to kind of go do that. Most people do that, you know, 95 to 99% more than they do putting. And so there just isn't enough practice in general for the part of the game that is hugely important.
So let's kind of run through, kind of a brief practice session, kind of give folks the at least the basics of how to practice their putting. Say I've got 15 minutes to tee time. My practice putting is going to be a whole lot different than if I'm going to spend 30 or 40 minutes on the green. So in both instances, you know, what am I in for?
If you got 10, 15 minutes that you're, you know, a lot of places the putting green is kind of near the first tee. If you're running over there just to kind of get ready to go play, a first and foremost thing to do is get a feel for the speed of the surfaces you're going to be putting on, and making sure that your distance control for the day is going to be pretty solid, because most people three putt or four putt because their distance control is poor. You know, they'll, from 20 feet, 25 feet, they'll hit it to 5-6 feet away, and then they'll miss that. And so learning to get the distance control down is really, really important. And, you know, very rarely do you see anyone actually working on that. And the best way to work on that is simply to actually remove a specific target, like the hole or, you know, whatever you're putting to, sort of take that out of the equation and purely putt to a distance. Like you might, you know, let's say you're standing on the middle of a putting green, you might face one way and attempt to putt it as close as you can to the fringe without rolling onto it, and then turn, you know, a little bit more the other way, and it's a different length putt, and putt to the fringe as close as you can without getting on it. And it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, right or left, it's about purely distance and work on that. And the fascinating thing is, if you watch young kids play golf, it's something they always struggle with. And the reason is that it actually resides in the frontal cortex of the brain that doesn't fully develop in a human until their early 20s. So, you know, as parents, oftentimes we're getting frustrated because our kids are, you know, 3, 4, and 5 putting. I, you know, I witnessed it with my kids, and a lot of it is just simply their brains aren't equipped to be great at it yet.
You know, I've heard this notion of practicing distance and that being more important than the accuracy in the beginning. And I suppose when you think about the notion, if, you know, if you're within 18 inches of the hole every time, you're going to make a whole lot of two putts.
Correct. It is. It's a distance control is a huge, huge part of it. And then, you know, back to then something that's a technical aspect of the stroke is the timing of the stroke is really important. And the timing of a putting stroke is kind of a 2-to-1 ratio. Whereas you take the putter back and you can kind of count like 1-to-1, you're at impact. So the timing of the stroke is that 2-to-1 ratio, and really getting people to lock in on that really helps distance control, because now it's really consistent. Whether you're hitting a 2-footer or a 40-footer, it's still a 2-to-1 ratio. And the same putt she has, a part of it is the timing, and you can actually see how the ratio is working.
You know, the notion, what occurred to me as you were talking, is if I wanted to learn putting, how much, you know, it's not like, like in 10 minutes, you or any instructor is going to teach me putting. There's obviously, we're all familiar with golf lessons as a subject. Is there such a thing as putting lessons? I mean, is there a series of lessons someone can go through to improve their putting?
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's part of, you know, typically when someone's working with a coach, they're looking at their game at a high level and finding out where they're losing strokes. And there's that, you know, that term that you hear now on tour a lot, it's called strokes gained. And, you know, if you're losing strokes on the putting green, which most people are, really diving into that and finding out, you know, where are you losing it from, you know, 5 to 10 feet in, you're losing it from longer putts, you know, where are we losing it, really working on those aspects and shoring it up. And it's amazing how much it will lower your score. But also what it does too, when you're sitting out there on a chip or a wedge shot or even a, you know, a 7-iron into the green, if you feel like that your putting is really solid, there's a lot less pressure on you to have to get it close to the hole, and you end up actually hitting better shots because of it.
I love it. You know, it's a subject that really sounds so simple. I mean, what's easier than being on a green with a flat stick and rolling a ball towards the hole. And when you talk about it, you know, there's a lot of complicated things that go into the notion of making you a better putter, but it comes right back down to a very simple theory. You know, try to get it, you know, as close to the hole as you can. I love
it. And the neat thing is, right, I mean, most any human that comes to see us to hit the driver better, you know, we are not going to, there's something just physically hitting that 310, 20 yard awesome tee shot, you know, not to burst your bubble, Frank, but probably not a drive you're going to hit all too often these days. And I'm including myself too, but anyone can really get better at putting and be, you know, as good as anyone in the world, to be honest. I mean, that's something that we can do if we put the time and energy into it.
I love it. Tom Martin, he's director of coaching and development at Hagen Oaks, and he is the man when it comes to instruction. Tom, I appreciate your time as always. Thanks much for joining us on the Golf to Go Radio Hour.
You bet, Frank. Thanks for having me.
It's the Golf to Go Hour with Frank LaRosa.
We are back here on the Golf to Go Radio Show with Chris Biederman. Chris is the senior sports reporter and columnist for the Sacramento Bee. And Scott and I ran into Chris a couple of weeks ago at Edgewood when we were up there for Media Day. And it was maybe on that day or the day before that Chris had published an article that he'd written that the title and certainly the message was fascinating to me. It was Warning and a Blessing. Golf is the best worst thing to ever happen during the pandemic. Chris It was a fascinating headline, and the story didn't disappoint. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You know, it's funny. I think I wrote that actually after having a bad round of golf, which came after a few good rounds, which sort of just speaks to how golf can impact your mood sometimes, depending how you play, and how a few shots here and there can maybe ruin your week. And the battle that you go through mentally with the game is what really stood out to me and what sort of inspired me to write that column. So I appreciate you guys having me on for that.
Absolutely. You know, it's always fascinating to me when you find that, you know, someone that does something else, you know, you're known for writing stories about the 49ers and sports around town and the Kings and so on and so forth. And, oh my gosh, look, there's a little crack in the armor. He's a golfer too. He suffers the same kind of pain we do. Scott and I talk about it all the time about, you know, how that one good shot, you know, kind of makes your day. But we've all experienced bad days on the course. Tell us, first of all, how you got into the game and how long you've been playing and really kind of, you know, when you tee it up on the golf course, is it for fun? Is it for competition? Or, you know, what's your motivation?
Yeah, so I didn't start playing golf until I moved back to Northern California from college. I went to Ohio State, and actually, now that I play golf a lot, I probably play once or twice a week. One of my great life tragedies is the fact that I went to Jack Nicklaus's school. I went to Ohio State, and he had two courses on campus, and I never utilized them because I didn't start playing until I moved home. And now in hindsight, I really wish I had, because there had been a lot of good golf I could have played in Columbus for, you know, I think it was at the time for students, it was like $20 a round. Wow. With a book ID. So I really missed out. And that's one of my big regrets as a golfer. But I started playing about 2011. And obviously, as a beginner, it was a struggle to break 100 for those first couple of years. But I'm to the point now where I'm probably, you know, depending on how you want to calculate a handicap, between a 10 or a 13, maybe depending on the day. And like so many other people, I really started picking up the game more seriously during the pandemic. And I used to play baseball, and that was a sort of, I was always real competitive. And after I stopped playing baseball, there was a need to scratch that competitive itch, in addition to, you know, getting outside and breathing some fresh air and walking around a little bit. I know, you know, some people don't love listening to music on the course, but, you know, I keep my Bluetooth speaker with me at all times. And you know, it's just a great way for me to be outside. And the thing I really love about golf is the incremental steps you can see in your game. And you mentioned that one shot that keeps you coming back. And I'm to the point now where I hope there are a few shots per round that I can think about, no matter what my score ends up being, that that I can keep coming back to as a way to motivate myself for the next time I play. So, you know, I'm kind of the weirdo who, when I'm at home and just watching TV, I might have a golf club in my hand and just might be visualizing what shots I hit with that club the next time I play. I don't know if I have ADHD or something undiagnosed or what, but I just really love the game and you know, the feeling that you get when you're able to consistently string together good shots and good holes and knowing where you come from in terms of your game and how, you know, maybe you would hit one good shot, one flush shot around back when you're first beginning to moving on to the point where the most of your shots you flush. It's just the process is really a fun part of the journey in golf, and it's cool to see it pay off as you get better and better.
You know, the fact that you're sitting at home with a golf club in your hand is probably part of the reason you're a 10 to a 13 as opposed to a 19 or a 20. You know, the way we approach the game mentally is certainly has a huge impact on how we play the game physically, and this whole notion of preparation is really important. We were talking with Mike Woods last week about how to practice, and as he says, you know, he'll get on the practice tee and kind of hit the shots that he will envision in the first few holes if he can do that, you know, and if he has the time, he'll go through the first nine hitting the shots that he's anticipating hitting on the golf course. Now, you know, that's certainly a very structured way to practice, but but that's the way you get better.
Yeah, absolutely. So much of it for me is about visualization, easy for me to say, and thinking about, you know, the types of shots you're going to hit and the shots that you've struggled with. One thing that I've really started to do over the last couple of years, I guess, particularly since the pandemic started, is I've never taken a golf lesson, like a human to human golf lesson interaction, like on a driving range or a golf course. But I watch almost to, I guess, an excessive extent is a lot of YouTube golf lessons. And I seek out like swing thoughts that I'm really struggling with or things that I really need to work on. And there's so much content on the internet that you can find to help yourself get better as a golfer without getting lessons. And that lessons are super important. And I understand that, but I feel like there's so much golf content on the internet that can allow you to get better. And that's really been a sticking point for me in terms of, you know, getting down to a 10 or 13, a low double digit handicap, I guess, has just been being able to watch a video, and sometimes they really click with you. And there have been, I could probably point to like 5 YouTube videos where I could say, man, that swing thought really changed the way I play and the way I think about the game and practice even. And, you know, a lot of it for me is wrist angles and not delivering too much loft, you know, not hitting the ball high and short, instead getting that sort of penetrating ball flight and that forward shaft lean and all that stuff. All that stuff I think about on the regular. But it's to your point, it's about visualization. And that's one part of the game that I do really enjoy, is just how many little things it takes. And you don't want to overpopulate your mind with too many swing thoughts, but I try to have one or two each round. And it's fun how you can go back and incorporate YouTube lessons and things like that into it, because that's something that's, you know, probably relatively new within the last 5 years or so that we have as golfers now that maybe, you know, we didn't have before that.
Yeah, I saw a quote from a pro the other day, a touring pro, as I remember, and it was something to the effect that the internet has just really exploded and made golf available to people, or made golf lessons available to people. I guess the caveat I would say, obviously you're an athlete having you know played baseball, but
former athlete.
But you know the notion of thinking you're doing what's on the internet and, you know, and maybe, you know, being a little bit off, for those that aren't quite the athletic type, that would be the scary part, but obviously it's worked for you, Scott. I don't know, you know, maybe we need to invite Chris out and help him us with our games. Huh?
We do. I think Chris and I are in similar journeys right now, 'cause I'm right around the 13 handicap myself. So I think you and I could relate on the course pretty well, but my bigger question is, does Ryan Day have you on his donor list to try and come up with that $13 million to try and save the Ohio State football program, as he described it?
I'm not entirely sure. I don't think Ryan Day would look at my profession and the fact that I spend as much time and money on golf as I do and think I would be the answer to whatever financial woes they might be having. But
now, Chris, I'm interested because you are, you know, the beat writer for the 49ers. You cover all things with the team. You know, Frank's had Steve Young on and his Players of the Game, and he's so passionate about the game and plays up in the celebrity tournament, so fond of the game. I'm just curious about any experiences in talking golf with the 49ers at all.
I talk to Robbie Gold, the kicker, about golf pretty regularly, and he's I think he's a 4 or 5, and I walked with him for a round at Edgewood last year during the American Century Championship, and he can really play. He's got a deal with Callaway, I believe. I think he gets, you know, fitted for new clubs every year, and he plays Pebble Beach a lot. I know he plays I believe he plays Paso Tiempo over in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and also Harding Park, which is where I got this hat that I'm wearing, for those who aren't watching on video. But it seems like Mike McGlinchey, I think before the right tackle, before he suffered his injury last year, he was actually working on his game to the point where he was trying to play in the Tahoe tournament this year. Also, I don't think he's playing, but he caddied for Robbie Gold last year and carrying around his bag. And it was just funny to see you know, this giant 6'8", 300+ pound lineman caddying for a kicker, you know, NFL kicker was kind of a funny dynamic. But, you know, it's funny to see football players in general really embrace the game. One guy they were paired with was Kyle Williams, who was a longtime defensive lineman for the Buffalo Bills. And, you know, a short, powerful guy, not necessarily the 6'5 guy, but probably 6'1, 6'2, probably close to 300 pounds, at least when he was playing defensive tackle. But it was just what stood out to me was just how great his short game was and how soft his hands were. And obviously these aren't characteristics you think about when you think about football, but that's really one of the things that makes golf unique is that, you know, body type doesn't really matter. You know, this is some of the longest hitters in the world are small guys. Rory McIlroy is what, 5'8", 5'9", and 165 pounds, you know, and Justin Thomas hits the hell out of the ball and he's not much bigger. You know, he's got to be what, 160, 170 soaking wet. So really, I think that's one of the things that makes golf unique is whether it's an NFL player, even NBA players, you see J.R. Smith really taking up the game. It's not about your physical stature. It's about your fundamentals and, you know, you don't need to be this big, strong guy to generate swing speed. I'm probably 6'1", 215, 220 on a good day. And, you know, I don't have a ton of club head speed. You know, I might swing at 100, 105 miles an hour where, you know, I play with some guys who are significantly smaller than me and they probably swing at 110, 115 and they outdrive me. And you know, I can't rely on my size or strength or whatever to power the ball down the fairway. It's about fundamentals when it comes to building speed. And I think that's one of the things that really makes golf unique. And that's what's fun about, you know, seeing football players play it, because you wouldn't expect maybe a kicker to be, you know, the longest driver on the team. Right. And then to see Kyle Williams, this NFL player, this defensive lineman, have super soft hands and an incredible short game and, you know, the real finesse aspect of it. So that's one of the things to me that I love about it. It's about the skill. It's not necessarily about physical stature.
You know, Chris, we lament every week that we've only got an hour for the show. And what I think we've found in this segment is that the 49er beat writer plays some golf. So we're going to have you back on the show, talk golf some more, and maybe even get you out on the course.
Yeah, we got to play around with them, Frank.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully playing around with me won't scare you guys off from having me on again. Hopefully it'll be a decent ball striking day for me.
We will look forward to it. That wraps up another edition of the Golf to Go Radio Hour here on Sactown Sports 1140. For Scott Marsh, I'm Frank LaRosa. Join us next week. We'll be back with more golf talk.